Hello, and welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, Chief Investment Officer. Baskin Wealth Management is an independently owned investment management firm with over $2 billion in assets under management, providing customized wealth management solutions and services to families and foundations. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations that make sense about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm here, as always, with Ernest Wong. Nice to see you today. It's almost April. Can you believe how quickly time is flying?
So it always, you know how this winter was super warm?
Yeah.
And then everybody thought that spring was going to come early. Like my kids even said, the groundhog said that.
Yeah.
But then, of course, as you expect, it snowed last weekend.
There was a fair bit of snow. My son went skiing in Vermont. I think they had a pretty good weekend. There was a large dump of snow, but I guess that's it for the season. So we're moving on to golf. Have you golfed yet, Ernest? When was the last time you went golfing?
I've never golfed okay. before.
Is that something
I've only ever been to a driving range?
Is that something you're interested in taking up at some point in time?
I took lessons last year.
Okay.
And I'm going to do it again.
Nice, nice. Golf is a good activity you can do with your wife, you can do with your friends, and even kids can learn how to do it at some point in time. My kids have no interest in playing golf or that kind of thing. They think it's a boomer sport.
So my sense for golf is that it's what like rich people used to do if they wanted to get to know other rich people.
Yeah.
Is that still a thing now?
I believe it is. I believe that obviously to join a golf club is not cheap. And a lot of people, of course, use it for business, take clients out or get to know other people. And they say that if you spend 4 or 5 hours on the golf course with someone, you really get to know them and people trust you more, which is kind of goes hand in hand with the book I'm reading. Have you read the book Influenced by Robert Cialdini?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So this is a book that Charlie Munger has recommended. It's one of his top books. And it talks about all these psychological things that sales companies can do, and marketing, as well as how you treat others to influence their behavior. So highly recommend. Check it out.
And golfing is one of them.
Well, just by providing a small, let's say, benefit to someone, they may, let's say I take out a client golfing, for example, or a prospect, they may, because of me spending money on golf and spending a day with them, I may get their portfolio for life.
Sounds good.
Whether or not I'm a good investor. But hopefully our clients will stick around with us because we're good investors and provide good service. And speaking about investing, it's the Long-Term Investing Podcast. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple today. And Apple's been in the news, Ernest. It's a lot of bad news headlines, of course. You know, we only focus on the bad news headlines. We never focus on all the things that are going right with Apple's business. And there's so many things that are going right. But Apple's been in the news because of faltering sales in China, as well as a landmark, I guess, antitrust complaint against Apple. And it's going to face a lawsuit. And that knocked a stock back. Your take on what's going on with Apple right now and the troubles it's having.
Yes. So the Department of Justice's antitrust lawsuit against Apple is the fourth antitrust lawsuit against big tech.
Okay.
So they have one against Google. They have one against Meta, Facebook. And they have one against
Amazon,
yes.
And of course, those that are old enough to remember, there was a large antitrust campaign against Microsoft about 24 years ago.
Yes.
And of course, had you bought Microsoft stock when the DOJ sued Microsoft for antitrust and held it to today, you would have made a lot of money. So some of this stuff is noise, but some of this stuff is important. And what's the important takeaway that you got from the complaint?
Yep. So the core of the complaint against Apple is that it's really about their product integration. The fact that they bundle everything in one product.
Okay.
So when you're buying an iPhone, You're getting the operating system, you're getting the phone, you're getting messaging, you're getting the App Store, you're getting all of Apple software.
When you buy the Apple iPhone, you buy into the Apple complex. Exactly. You don't really get any Android software, nor do people that use iPhones want to use that. They love the iPhone iOS, the operating system. They love that. They love that environment.
And the complaint is that Apple's product integration and integration among all the aspects of the iPhone is limiting competition. So for example, Apple doesn't allow third-party wallets on their on the iPhone, for example.
Okay.
Right? You have to use Apple Wallet.
Yeah.
Apple Pay, right?
Which is very convenient, by the way. I love Apple Pay.
Like the fact that the Apple Watch, right, has access to certain functions in the iPhone that other watches don't.
Okay.
Right. These are the kinds of things that are under attack here.
But is the main reason why the Department of Justice is going after Apple is because of Apple's 30% fees that they used to charge on their Apple Store to developers? Is that really the crux of why the government is looking at Apple hard? Because a lot of the complaints seem nonsensical, in my opinion.
Yeah, so there's a view that the public discontent, so to speak, about Apple's fees on developers, the 30%, is what is causing the antitrust investigation.
So what we're talking about is if you download an app on your iPhone.
Candy Crush.
Which, you know, fun game. My wife was a big fan of it. Every time you buy, you can't pass a level and you need to upgrade and you pay a couple dollars for the game, Apple takes 30% of that $2. 60 cents goes to Apple, $1.40 goes to the maker of Candy Crush, which is Activision. And many feel that's too high a percentage take by Apple and really limits developer profits.
Yeah, we can do like another whole podcast episode on this specific topic.
We will.
But what's interesting is that their practices around the App Store are not really in this complaint. And I think the reason for that is that Apple already faced a lawsuit against this very specific topic when Epic sued them. Epic Games sued them. And so I think that the core of the argument is that because Apple is bundling and tying all these things together, it makes it really hard for you as a consumer to switch away from the iPhone. And therefore, because you can't switch, it allows them to raise prices.
Which is true. However, then no one's asked me if I want to switch. And I've seen those that you, no offense, you use an Android.
Yes.
I use an Apple. You couldn't pay me to switch to Android. I've seen that. I've seen the types of apps and the configuration and the environment, and it's not for me. Plus, I have my AirPods, my iPad. My wife has a Mac. We have Apple TV. We enjoy these things, and there's no way that I'm going to switch from Apple to another platform unless it's better and does better things for me. And from what I've gathered, it doesn't. I mean, and you could tell me I'm completely wrong, but I assume that's kind of similar for an Android user, that they don't want to switch to Apple environment as well because all their life is on the Android.
Yes, there are a whole host of legal issues around the argument from the government. Including, I think one that's very important is that Apple cannot be compelled, and it's been legally proven, that they should not be forced to make services on platforms that they don't operate, right? So like, for example, like there's no reason to expect that Apple should have to make iMessage available on Android. It's not their platform, right? And they don't, they shouldn't have a, there's no legal responsibility for them to do that.
And for those who don't know, the iMessage is, if I'm an Apple user and I text my wife, who's also an Apple user, it will show up as blue text. We know that we both have Apple. If I text you, Ernest, your responses come back to me in green. So I know you're not an Apple user. And a lot of people look down at those that don't have the Apple iMessage. But I like, what is Is that really a reason to sue Apple for antitrust?
Well, I think that's the issue, mm-hmm. is that on the other level is that you have to prove that there was actual consumer harm
yeah.
as a result of these practices.
That's right.
And, mm-hmm. not just consumers. Basically, the government would have to prove that consumers are stuck with Apple because of all the things that they do to lock
that's
you in
right.
and
that's
not
right.
because they actually like iPhones.
So what did you learn from the complaint? Because I think it's like 80 pages. Did you learn anything that would make you want to own more Apple shares, change your mind about being an Apple shareholder?
Well, I think that most of the things in the complaint are fairly ticky-tack minor details mm-hmm. that are not... Even if they were implemented and Apple lost the case,
yeah.
they don't fundamentally change Apple's business model, which is selling really good phones mm-hmm. and products, right? So I don't think it'll be a massively financially material event.
So some remedies could include Apple changing some of its practices
yeah.
around iMessage.
Yes.
Apple reducing, even though that's not in the complaint about the Apple store percentage, that could be a right. remedy.
Maybe allowing some third-party products to be able to connect and mm-hmm. access certain data mm-hmm. on the iPhone.
Generally, these lawsuits do end with a financial remedy.
Possibly.
But the expectation, those that are shareholders, is this is going to go on for a number of years.
Yes, I think what we've seen from Apple and what you should expect for such a large case is that Apple is going to fight this to the death.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be many years
yeah.
before we know how this plays out.
Very good. So that's the complaint. I don't think there's anything to worry about specifically or anything to do with your shares as a result. In fact, if you've read through the complaint, you might get more positive about Apple's ecosystem, its moat, its competitive advantage, because the Department of Justice complaint lays out a very strong bull thesis on the Apple company.
Yeah, I think what often happens for these types of complaints is that they do a pretty good job of laying out the positive features of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, one of the things that they said is that 88% of teenagers today want an iPhone as their next phone,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing.
It's huge.
If you are bullish on Apple.
I think one of the things that stuck out to me was 98% of Apple iPhone users will repurchase or buy another iPhone when time comes to get a new phone.
Right.
So, I mean, that is a stunning number. For example, Costco members, only 92% of them renew their membership every year. So you're talking about a product where 98% of the users will buy the next upgrade at some point in time. That's huge. So speaking about upgrading at the next point in time, that's one of the things that Apple's currently wrestling with. Its phones are very good. The features are very good. So people haven't been upgrading as fast as they have been in the past. And of course, China, you know, there's always bull and boom and bust issues that happen with Apple in China. This is not a new thing where Apple's lost market share before, where a competing Chinese phone maker has taken market share, and kind of shows the Department of Justice complaint how silly it is. At some point in time, any company can lose its moat or its product can go out of fashion. But your take, Ernest, on the short-term fundamental things that are impacting Apple?
I think the situation for Apple today is very similar to what it was in 2015 and 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Stock is not as cheap as it was back then.
No.
Obviously.
No. I think back then it was, 10, 11, 12 times earnings, which was insane. And that's why the stock has done so well off 2015.
Mm-hmm. But there are very similar, it's a very similar narrative going around mm-hmm. for Apple as it was at that point.
Okay.
Number one is that the replacement cycle is not going. They're facing a replacement cycle headwind. Mm-hmm. So people are upgrading their iPhones at a slower rate than they used to.
That's right. I just upgraded from my iPhone 13 to my 15. My 13, I got some water in it and it just wasn't charging and there was nothing I could do to fix it. I got the 15. I read a lot from, you know, people saying, well, the, you know, 15 is not that much better than the 14, not better than 13 and the 12. I beg to differ. I love the 15. It works so much faster. I'm very happy that I upgraded, and but I can understand why, you know, the why no one would or few would upgrade so quickly. The 13 worked good enough, and the new apps, the new software is not there's not requiring enough memory or whatever silicon that would force you that you have to upgrade because your phone's not going to work with the new software.
The second thing is that there's issues around demand in China. Mm-hmm. So in 2015, it was concerns around WeChat, mm-hmm. and the fact that like there were super apps like WeChat that allowed made it easy for you to switch away from iPhones, mm-hmm. right? And so today, again, people are concerned about iPhone demand in China because of competing Chinese producers, mm-hmm. and also like some maybe geopolitical issues.
There's
some well.
There's definitely some geopolitical stuff going on.
So that's
on.
Another thing that's very similar to back then. Mm-hmm. I think the third thing that's similar again is the narrative that Apple is not an innovative company. Mm-hmm. In 2015, if you remember, Steve Jobs was dead. Tim Cook has been CEO for a bit. Mm-hmm. And they haven't really released anything new for a while. And people said, you know, Steve Jobs is dead. Tim Cook's a, you know, he's a bit of a engineer, supply chain guy.
Yeah.
Doesn't really know how to innovate.
Not a product guy, not an innovative guy.
And you know, Apple is not doing anything exciting,
yeah.
right? And so I think there's kind of a similar story going around today that Apple, you know, they're mostly focused on just milking cash flow out from developers. They don't really care about like launching new products. They just killed the car,
yeah.
right? So yeah, very parallel situation. And, you know, we know what happened since
yeah.
then.
Yeah. So we'll find out this summer, of course, what Apple's AI strategy. There's been a lot of rumors as to Apple maybe licensing technology from Google, as well as some rumors that it might license some technology in China. Well, no one quite knows. Apple never comments, by the way, on these rumors. They tell you what they tell you when they want to tell you. But there'll be a new iPhone refresh, of course. Happens every September. It's already April in a few days. And there'll be new products and Apple's not, I don't think Apple's resting on its laurels. Many people think it is. It's just, you know, milking its cash flow from many sources. But, you know, this is a company that still wants to add more products and software and services for you on its ecosystem and to get you to buy more products and services and to be at the forefront of having the best technology. May not be first, but ultimately the best. And, you know, the stock has come off recently and we've been shareholders earnest since 2012 and I'm not selling it.
That's good.
Very good. So our feature discussion is a company that you and I have been watching for a long time. I've been watching for a very long time. We finally pulled the trigger on purchasing it. It goes to show you, you're never too late to buy a stock. And, you know, if you believe that the results going forward are going to be strong or stronger and the valuation is attractive, you can do it. And this is a company that we think has high returns on invested capital and a long runway of growth. And the name of the company is Alimentation Couche-Tard.
So Couche-Tard is one of the largest operators of convenience stores in the world.
Yeah.
They have about 16,000 stores.
16,000 stores in the world. And it's not just a Canadian or US story. This is, as you said, global yep. gas station owner.
Yep. Mm-hmm. They have about 7,000 in the US, about 2,000 in Canada, mm-hmm. the rest in Asia, Europe. And I think some of them are under licensed agreements. Okay. So for Circle K,
yeah.
the Circle K banner.
And so for those that don't speak French and what is Alimentation Couche-Tard, just think of it as the owner of gas stations under the Circle K brand.
And convenience stores.
And convenience store. And I've been calling the company, I call it Couche. People don't seem to like that because in French that means diaper. So we'll try to call the company ATD here on the podcast.
Sure.
Or Couche-Tard. Maybe we won't call it Couche. We can call it Couche in our privately.
ATD has been one of the best performing Canadian stocks over the last
35 years.
Yeah, 35 years.
Yeah.
I don't know what the compound return since then is, but
it's gigantic. I think it's over 30%. So for 35 years, had you bought the stock 35 years ago, which is, I don't know, 1990, 1989, I wish my parents would have bought that for me. You would have compounded your money over 30% for 35 years. You'd be quite rich.
And I think there's two elements to the ATD story, so to speak. Mm-hmm. First is the fact that the convenience store and the gas station business is a good place to be. Mm-hmm. It's a sector that you want to invest in. And then the second is around capital allocation, which is, of course, something that we talk a lot about mm-hmm. on this mm-hmm. podcast. Mm-hmm. So convenience stores. Convenience stores have historically been a really good business. By their name, they're convenient. They provide quick access to things like food, pop, like cigarettes, lotto tickets, yep. beer, those kinds of things.
Quick consumables that yep. Provide you quick satisfaction, and you probably want to go back and get some more at some point in time.
Yep. Yep. They have high margins mm-hmm. because their focus is on convenience.
Yeah. Generally, I think, Ernest, the margin's around 30% in convenience stores.
Yeah.
So,
something like that.
Yeah. So that's a pretty good business. So usually grocery stores have margins. Costco, for example, only makes 10% margins on selling food.
I would say it's actually convenience stores are the exact opposite of Costco, yeah. right?
Yeah, I'm just trying to talk yeah. about giving yeah. our audience an idea of how much money they make selling gum and candy and tobacco. It's quite high margins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, like if you think about it, Costco is in, like, they sell the cheapest things in large quantities
yeah.
at very remote locations.
Yeah.
Convenience stores are the opposite of that. Exactly. They sell things in the smallest quantity possible in the most convenient place at the highest prices they can, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what you want at that moment.
Yeah.
Convenience stores generally control the best real estate, the most accessible in terms of like driving.
Yep.
That's why they're usually on street corners, mm-hmm. because they need to be the place that makes it easy for you to stop. They are relatively economically insensitive mm-hmm. because people are still buying these things.
You got to get to work. You got to get to work. You got to fill up your car with gas. You may want a coffee. Maybe their coffee that they sell is cheaper than the coffee you buy at some of the fancier coffee. And sometimes, Ernest, the convenience stores are linked with maybe a better food, like a Tim Hortons or some kind of fast food chain as well, to drive more traffic.
And there's minimal e-commerce risk, mm-hmm. unlike the vast majority of retail.
That's right. If I want my bag of Sour Patch Keys in the next few minutes, I'm going to go to the convenience store. I'm not going to wait till tomorrow to have them from Amazon. Probably won't want them at that point in time.
Yeah. And so what ATD has done, along with a few other players, is that they have been consolidating the convenience store industry mm-hmm. over time. Mm-hmm. And so, like, as you go around more and more today, you'll see that more and more of the stores are under either Circle K or 7-Eleven
yeah.
or these kinds of brands.
Yeah.
And it's still a fairly fragmented landscape. Mm-hmm. I think 60% of the US is independent convenience stores.
Okay. And a number of them are just like one-off stores, yeah. like Barry's On the Run Gas or whatever yeah. it is. And okay, got
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And so what the strategy of ATD is, they would go in, they would make these acquisitions of these chains, mm-hmm. sometimes big, sometimes small. Mm-hmm. They would rebrand them to Circle K
yep.
so that everybody knows what it is and what they represent.
Yep.
And they would improve the operations of the convenience store to drive sales, mm-hmm. right? And that's a consistent theme that you've seen from the management all the way back from when the company was founded in 1986. Mm-hmm.
They are very good retailers.
Yes.
They know how to make a store attractive inside for you to purchase the maximum amount of products at the right price that you're looking for, and to get your eyes and your body moving to what they want you to buy.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas if you went into one that wasn't run like that, it may not get as much sales per square foot.
Right. So mm-hmm. there's a very good book written about the background of ATD mm-hmm. called Daring to Succeed. Mm-hmm. It's about how the founder, Alain Bouchard, mm-hmm. he would basically go into convenience stores and he would bring a hammer and he would know which freezer to upgrade.
Yeah.
He would know where to put the gum in the store, right? Mm-hmm. Like he would do these very small things, but know how to immediately double the sales of the store.
And it adds up over time, especially if you're getting 30% margins on small little products. You need volume. And the more sales you can get, obviously, the better per square foot and the better returns to you as a shareholder.
Yep. And so I think there's good reason to think that consolidation in the convenience store industry is going to continue. Mm-hmm. Number one is that if you're a big, sophisticated giant like ATD, mm-hmm. right, you have, number one, you have retailing expertise that it's hard to be good at selling things, right? But more importantly is that you have scale. You have the ability to negotiate discounts in terms of buying candy. Mm-hmm. You have the ability to develop a loyalty program. Like mm-hmm. people know what your brand is. You can do analytics about what product is selling and what's not. Yeah. You can...
Let me stop you right there. Just to give an example, if you speak to someone who owns a one-off convenience store, chances are they would just drive to Costco to pick up a lot of stuff for their store on a Sunday or Saturday, whatever, and fill up their store by doing that physical work at Costco. What a pain.
Yeah.
Whereas Couche-Tard or one of the other competitors has the ability to buy at discounts from a retailer or wholesaler. It just makes so much sense to consolidate and fragment your convenience store under the Circle K brand.
And what happens is that because these big players have so much ability to drive sales in the convenience store mm-hmm. and fuel volumes at the gas stations, mm-hmm. they have much better cost structures than all the little competitors mm-hmm. who just basically have to keep raising prices on mm-hmm. at the pump
yeah.
just to keep up, right? And that's been something that these players have been benefiting from over the last, especially in the last 3 years.
So Couche-Tard uses the gas station as a traffic builder to yes. bring money and to bring people into the convenience store. So
they make some money,
and we'll talk about gas, but there's two parts of their business, of course, selling convenience products as well as selling gasoline.
Yes. So today about half of their profit comes from selling gasoline mm-hmm. and half of it comes from the convenience store and car wash. And
even though there's so much more volume on selling gasoline, but that is a much lower margin business and yes. one where the margins are extremely volatile. Because oil prices yes. and refinery prices move around all the time.
And so that's essentially the investment thesis for mm-hmm. Couche-Tard is that they're great operators. They'll continue to make acquisitions mm-hmm. and grow the business.
So this company went public, you know, split adjusted and now a few cents a share with how many convenience stores or gas stations when they started?
They started with five.
Now they have yeah. 16,000. So this is the power of compounding, of course. And I believe, Ernest, now Couche-Tard has switched modes and they're now looking to buy back a lot more stock. So, you know, you get the double home run, so to speak, of the ability to continue to add more stores as well as buy back stock, reduce your share count. That's the power of compounding.
Yes. I think that as they are getting bigger, mm-hmm. naturally, it becomes harder and harder for them to make acquisitions at the same speed that they used to do, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I think the shares today are still trading at a fairly low multiple.
So, yeah, I agree with that. And a few months ago, Couche-Tard had its analyst day where they gave targets that we think we can double our business over the next 5 years. I think the target was from 2023 to 2028. And they said, well, we doubled our business from 2018 to 2023, acquiring gas stations, improving margins, acquiring convenience stores. And now, of course, using the same strategy, we're going to buy more convenience stores. We're going to build some as well and buy back stock and increase margins. And so far, the plan hasn't gone so well in the last quarter, of course. Why don't you talk a little bit about how volatile gas margins can be for Couche-Tard?
So gas margin is basically the difference that between what they get at the pump price mm-hmm. and what they are paying for their fuel.
Yeah.
And this is a fairly volatile result, right? Because Couche-Tard has algorithms based on kind of regional competition, which sets the price that you see at the gas station. Whereas the price that they're paying is, there's a lot of things that go into that, right? Mm-hmm. There's what oil prices are. There is what refineries are operating, what transportation is like. Mm-hmm. And
of course, demand.
Yes.
Miles driven.
Yes. And big companies like Couche-Tard often have very sophisticated fuel trading operations mm-hmm. that are trying to source fuel and then move it to trying to buy fuel at the cheapest place.
That's right.
And move it to where.
And it's expensive to move fuel because it's liquids. And,
And so mm-hmm. they're in the most recent quarter, basically they said things were relatively normal.
Yeah.
There was not very much volatility in the gas market.
Yeah.
So as a result, fuel margins were lower than expected.
Yeah. But this is going to be something that's going to be ongoing going forward and something that will even out over the long term.
Yes.
One of our beliefs, Ernest, is that fuel margins will remain higher going forward than they were in the past. Do you want to just lay out that case as to our reasons why, our thoughts why?
Yeah, and that really has to do with the scale advantages that mm-hmm. Couche-Tard has over independents mm-hmm. that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Independents, they have less ability to cover fixed costs, like the labor costs, the cost of rent, because they just have less traffic than the big guys, mm-hmm. right? They don't have as sophisticated a convenience store business. Mm-hmm. And so they have to make it up on fuel. They have to raise pump prices to cover that, mm-hmm. especially in the last couple of years when things like labor have gone through the roof. And so as a result, I think it's a good bet to think that fuel margins are going to stay elevated going forward.
I think we've also, Ernest, seen a number of gas stations close down. Where there used to be three or four on a corner, now there's three or two or one. And of course, the last one standing can charge whatever margins they want, right? Where you have three or four competing on the same price, you're not going to drive around 10 miles, 10 kilometers to the best price, unless you're Ernest Wong. You're probably just going to, okay, I need gas, here it is. I'll go to the one that's cheaper.
Line up for half an hour at Costco.
I never understood why people line up for half an hour Costco for gas, but whatever. I mean, that would just make me want to shoot myself. But however, there's reason to believe that costs are going up to run a gas station, convenience stores. The margins are very tight. If you're not a Couche-Tard or you're not one of the big majors. Also, of course, another thesis is a lot of the oil and gas companies, they're not in the business of running gas stations and thought processes. At some points, they may sell down their gas stations to Couche-Tard. A lot of them are also facing ESG and want to reduce their carbon exposure or take advantage of other opportunities. Maybe there's more margins in being an oil and gas producer. So a lot of tailwinds for Couche-Tard to make acquisitions going forward. Would you agree?
Yes, and I think to your point about the integrated energy companies selling off gas stations. I think this is especially true in Europe going forward, mm-hmm. where most of the gas stations and convenience stores are tied to these mega oil companies that have built up these integrated businesses from finding to refining to transportation and to gas stations.
That's right. And investors usually like more pure play investments. They like companies that focus more on one or two business lines instead of four or five. We've seen that in a lot of the integrated oil companies. Chevron sold off its gas stations.
ATD just did one
from
Total Energies.
Yeah.
Yep. So.
And there's always a rumor that Suncor is looking to sell its Petro-Canada.
Yes, that's been under discussion for a while.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room, something that I think everybody will always ask about when you're owning a company that sells gasoline is electric vehicles. Aren't you guys worried that in a few years, we're all going to be driving Teslas or hybrids and there's no reason you're not going to sell any gasoline and I'm just going to fill up my car or charge my car at home so I don't need to go to the gas station to get my Sour Patch Kids or my coffee. I'll just make it at home. Isn't that a risk for Couche-Tard long term?
Well, I think there's good reason not to be concerned, too concerned mm-hmm. about electric vehicles in even the medium term.
Okay.
I think in the long term, I forgot who it was who said that in the long term, we're all dead. So
that makes me feel better. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
But
we'll talk about the medium term.
Yes. Then. In the medium term.
Yeah.
So in the medium term, well, first of all, as we discussed before, only half of the business is related to fuel.
Okay.
And I think what's interesting about the gas station business is that most of the convenience store transactions are not related to the fuel transaction.
Hmm.
I think they say that ATD said that only 10% of their transactions are both fuel and convenience store.
Okay.
So people are, it's not that people are going to fuel up and then going in to buy pop and mm-hmm, chips. Mm-hmm. They were going to go buy pop and chips, and it didn't matter whether they were going to
make sense.
Whether they were going to go for the gas
station. Or maybe they need to get their car washed or fill their tires with air. There's other reasons why you go to the gas station, even if you have an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So first of all, it's only half of the business that we're discussing.
Okay.
Right? The gas station portion. Mm-hmm. I think more importantly is that it'll take a really, really long time before all cars are electric. And
as you said, in the long term, we'll all be dead. So yes. We'll be dead before that happens.
And the reason for that is in the US today, about 7 to 8% of new car sales are electrics and hybrids.
Okay. So there's about 14 to 17 million new cars sold every year in the United States. And is that all cars, including trucks? And
no, it's light vehicles.
So light vehicles. So we're not even talking about trucks or commercial vehicles, which are I think very few are electric.
Yes.
So 7 or 8% of all new car sales are electric out of that 14 million per se. So 12 to 13 million cars every year are still combustible.
Yes. And more importantly is that every year, only 4 to 5% of cars are replaced.
Yeah.
So basically, if you do the math, right?
Well, I once read there's like well over 300 million light vehicles in the United States.
Right.
Okay.
So what this means is that even if all cars were electric today, all new car sales.
All new, 100% of that 14 million was new cars.
It would still take 20 years before all cars were electric.
Yeah.
And we're at 7 to 8% today, mm-hmm. right? So that kind of gives you some sense of how long it'll take before all the cars are electric.
A very long time. And of course, that doesn't take into account people who drive large distances for a living, or where there will be no infrastructure for electric vehicles for an extremely long time.
And I think there is increasing evidence that electric car penetration, electric car sales, is going to be, it's not going to go as fast as what some people have thought.
Now, there are some governments that want to phase out only electric vehicles will be sold past 2035. And we're rapidly getting to that target. It's only 11 years to go now. But many others think that is an impossible and a silly target and just an aspirational goal.
Right. Just last week, the EPA, mm-hmm. They were forced to reduce their target for EV sales because the consumer demand just isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. So, and then I think lastly on the electric car topic is that there is upside for Couche-Tard as well, right? To the extent that electric car sales is faster than expected. Mm-hmm. First of all, consolidation is going to continue to happen. So they're going to have some benefits from fuel volumes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And they are rolling out electric chargers, right?
So Couche-Tard has been running a program. Norway, for example, I think is mostly electric. And they've said, Ernest, that convenience store sales are higher than they were pre-electric. Is that right?
Yep. So what's interesting is that Couche-Tard, they own gas stations in Scandinavia, which is the most highly penetrated place for electric vehicles in the world.
Wonderful for them. Yeah.
So, and more importantly, it gives them some good lessons into how the market's going to evolve in the future, mm-hmm. right? So the first thing that they've seen is that gasoline sales have actually remained fairly stable throughout that time. So far, at least.
Yeah. Just like you mentioned, just because all new sales are EVs, they're still millions and millions and millions of regular cars that need gasoline and will until they get replaced. It's not like you can force someone to upgrade and buy an EV.
Yes.
So that's going to take time.
Mm-hmm. Number two is that, as you noted, they are finding much better uptake on convenience.